Welcome to episode 4 of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast with me, your host, Eric Drysdale. Our other host, Jared Hunter, is unavailable for today's conversation. Today, I'm glad to be joined by Karina Isayev, who's a computational biologist and bioinformatician who works in cancer research. Karina, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Karina, before we dive into some of your research and some questions I've wanted to ask you for a while, can you give a bit of a backgrounder, where you're from? I think you were born in Israel, right? How old were you when you moved to Canada? Just, and how did you get into cancer research? So just give us the potted bio, if you could.
Sure. Yeah, I was born in the south of Israel in a town called Ashkelon by the Mediterranean Sea. So it was a really, in many ways, a really nice place to grow up. And just before I turned 11, my immediate family, so my parents, my sister, my grandmother moved from Israel to Canada, to Toronto, and basically the rest of my family lives in Germany. So we kind of split up. Essentially, all through school, you know, I really liked math. I didn't really like science in the beginning. I think I just wasn't maybe exposed to it in the best ways. And at first I thought maybe global health was interesting. I mean, I still think it's really interesting, but that's kind of where it started. So when I just, in U of T, you can basically choose your major or your specialist, the program that you want to kind of, you know, specialize in through your undergrad. And the first program that I chose was actually a specialist in global health. But of course, that ended up changing. And I'm really grateful that at least at U of T, it's really flexible. You can change your major pretty much at any time. So, you know, in second year, I met Phil, who I think was a guest on your previous
episode 3 of the podcast. Yes.
And he was also in life science at the time. We were both in second year when we met, you know, doing all the general life science courses like human genetics, cell biology and whatnot. But he decided around that time to actually give computer science a try. So he was really excited about these courses that he was taking and basically motivated me and kind of inspired me to actually try it. And I realized, you know, around that time, like I never actually really gave computer science or even coding a try. So I figured, okay, this could be, you know, a good and useful thing to try. And if I don't stick to it, at least I'll learn something useful. And the first year computer science course at U of T is actually a great course. The lectures are amazing. Like it's very hands-on. So basically because of Phil, I, you know, even considered bioinformatics and as a program and kind of the courses that go into it. So that's how I took my first computer science course. And I did pretty well in it. I really liked it. Learned some Python, which was great. And that really gave me a good foundation for the future. And even though I didn't end up doing bioinformatics as a specialist, I ended up doing a double major in biochemistry and nutritional science. I think the skills I learned even in that just one course were really useful. In any case, I can't really explain how I made all those decisions that followed. Things just kind of happened and I went, you know, with what my gut was telling me. So yeah, for some reason I didn't stick to bioinformatics at that time. I tried doing some more research in, you know, more wet lab environments. So my first ever like lab experience outside of class was at a Drosophila lab. So I think it was, if I remember correctly, it was like an evolutionary lab. So they were looking at, you know, fruit flies. And I was responsible for like maintaining these fruit fly populations and like feeding them and, you know, sometimes killing them. So that was my first experience. And then, you know, in third year, I did a thesis in a biochemistry lab. And that was really like my first big research experience. The biochemistry thesis program is pretty intense. But luckily I had a really good mentor. Again, I don't remember why, but in fourth year, I decided again to try bioinformatics. So I kind of, I applied for a research assistant position at a lab that kind of had an opening for a student to try and work on a bioinformatics project. So yeah, that was pretty cool. That was kind of outside of class again. And then the summer after I finished undergrad, I spent the summer working at a lab that does basically schizophrenia research. I was sort of their computational person, you know, and of course I didn't have that much experience at the time and they had a lot of, you know, expectations. They had a lot of projects. When you have a sort of pressure, of course it kind of pushes you to learn things really quickly. So that's kind of where I learned R. I guess I forgot to mention that just before that, I, you know, as you might have guessed by this point, like med school didn't really work out. Mostly I never really applied. I wrote my MCAT and it was fine, but I just never committed to completing my application. I think there was a lot of fear that maybe I wasn't good enough, that my grades weren't good enough, but you know, who knows, right? Because I never actually applied. Instead, I was thinking of what else to do. And at one point I considered nursing school, and then I ended up considering graduate school. And that's actually because basically in fourth year, I was in the band with some other guys from U of T, most of whom were in physics or I think astronomy. And one of them just started his master's in the program of medical biophysics. And I've never even heard of this program, even though it's, you know, part of University of Toronto. So he told me about it and he was like, oh, actually, there's still time to apply. And he told me a lot of great things about it. So I figured, okay, like, you know, why not? And my parents also like really pushed me to do this. And to be honest, I had no other plans for what to do after graduation. So it was one of those things where I was like, okay, I'm just gonna apply. I guess it sounds a lot like I was never really sure that I would end up in research. It wasn't really something that I truly planned for. I'm really, really grateful that it all kind of happened like that. So basically, yeah, then I started my master's in medical biophysics, and most of the program, not all, but most of the labs in the program are devoted to cancer research. I think the program actually started at Princess Margaret Hospital, so it was really cancer focused. All the rotations that I did, different labs were all cancer related, and all of the work I did was computational, because by that point I knew for sure that I wasn't going to go back to experimental work. So that's how I guess I got into cancer research.
It's interesting that you describe a lot of the points in your trajectory here as, you know, you're not sure how you made that decision and you didn't really know what you wanted to do. But from my vantage point of someone who didn't start in biology at all, the fields that you're interested in, they all have a lot of similarities. So public health, epidemiology, nursing, medicine, biology. So within each of these fields, of course, the research is quite different, but from someone on the outside, there is clearly a theme there.
Yeah, I guess so.
Before we move on to the next topic I want to bring up, I want to clarify one thing for the record. So I've noticed in various publications online on Google Scholar, you're referred to as Karen, Karen, Karina, Karinskis. Let's have the record settled right now. What is your name?
Great question. I think this confuses a lot of people. I think the simplest way to put this is legally, based on my birth certificate and my passport, my name is Karen, K-E-R-E-N. You know, there's a story to this, and it's basically that when I was born, my parents were really new to Israel. They didn't speak Hebrew really well. So my dad went to register me, and I think from what I remember, it was like a rabbi that had to sign my birth certificate, and he basically refused to put down Karina, which is what my parents wanted to name me. So he said it has to be a Jewish name, and Karen, spelled like that, is the Jewish name. So that's why I'm legally called Karen. But of course, you know, throughout my life, Karina was what everyone really called me. So the reason why sometimes you see it spelled as K-A-R-I-N, like a short form of Karina, is because in Israel, people called me Karin. You know, it's not really that different. It's just like a short form of Karina. I'd say I at this point, I go basically by all three. At work, people call me Karen, you know, because of the whole legal name situation. My friends call me Karina. I really don't care, but I think I would say all three can be my name at this point.
That's great. That's very flexible of you. Okay, so we're going to talk about some fairly technical topics today. Technical to an outside audience, but they'll be standard for you. So I want to give a quick refresher for people listening that may not have a lot of this scientific training on what are the differences between biologists, computational biologists, bioinformaticians, just the sort of people that are going to be in the landscape that we're describing. So let me give you my quick, like what I think of these terms, and then I want you just to add on to anything with some additional details. Biologists, I tend to associate with people who are actually doing experiments in the wet lab. And so that means they're experimenting on mice, looking at cell lines, Drosophila, as you mentioned, so mosquitoes. And then computational biologists are their companions who actually analyze and look at the numbers that get generated from these biological experiments and model various biological processes like how genes evolve in a evolutionary sense, and again, in very specific computational models. And then lastly, bioinformaticians are people who have a specific specialty in understanding how you measure these various biological molecules, whether that's DNA or RNA, and the various computer tools you need to do that. Do you want to add anything on to that, Karina?
I begin by saying that I don't think these things are truly defined. People sort of perceive them differently. And you'll see that because I think I have a total different idea of what these things mean to what you said.
Okay, perfect. That's so great.
From my experience, in my opinion, I'd say that a biologist is really anyone who studies biology, whether it's experimental or computational. And maybe before, you know, previously, maybe it was more experimental people, but now I think the field evolves so much that there are tons of computational biologists who are truly biologists because they know the bio so well, and that's why they're able to do their job. I think really comes down to experimental biologists and computational biologists. And of course, these days, like, the two have to work together to achieve good research and good science. I think what a computational biologist is basically someone who knows the underlying biology of their research topic really, really well, which means they have a really good understanding of the literature. They can predict certain events, biologically speaking, that could happen, and that's how they would set up their analysis, right? Because if you have no understanding of the biological context, doing analysis on that data might be really difficult and potentially less meaningful. That's kind of what difference is to me. And when I say I'm a computational biologist, I do think I'm still a biologist. And maybe others would disagree. And maybe that's because I started off as an experimental biologist and became a computational biologist. Others might disagree, especially if they've come from a computational background. So that's just kind of how I perceive it. And to me, I wouldn't call myself a bioinformatician, really, even though I think that's technically what my title is. Because to me, bioinformaticians are people who have a really good understanding of the different algorithms that are used for things like DNA sequencing or RNA sequencing, or all of these really complex methods that allow biologists to do their job. That's kind of, you know, where the differences, how I see the differences between these categories.
Yeah, that's a really fair point. I think then what you're saying is that the way that you're referring to these different subfields of biology is the same way, say, in economics, you might have someone who's a housing economist, a labor economist, someone who's in financial economics, but they'd all describe themselves as economists at the end of the day, because they're still using the same set of principles for their analysis. They're just looking in different areas, so to speak. So that's a really good point. Okay, great. So now that we've gotten some of the terminology down for in terms of who's actually doing this research, I want to hear your perspective on, because you're in cancer research, as you've mentioned, and I mentioned at the beginning, what does this cancer research landscape look like? And the reason I want to talk about this is that I think a lot of people, if you were to poll the public and say, what are your thoughts on cancer research? People would give two thumbs up, being like, it's great. We all know someone who's died or has been affected by cancer, and we hear about all these amazing discoveries. But what does the field actually look like? To me, I see lots of different people, and they're doing quite distinct things. So while the public may think of that there's cancer researchers, I think that there's people that are looking at, say, animal models to understand cancer, people who are looking at genetic networks or bioinformatics tools for cancer. And if any one of these people were to go to the other fields, say seminars or talks, they actually might not be able to follow really what the research actually is doing, because it's just too technical or too specific. What do you think about that statement? Is that fair, that cancer research is actually quite broad and that the different people in it might not actually have that much connection with their different counterparts?
Yeah, absolutely. I think cancer, just the term cancer, is so broad, right? Because within cancer, you have so many different types of cancers where each one could essentially be, you know, an independent disease. So you kind of have to think about almost each type of cancer separately. But at the same time, from, I don't know, I think the last couple of years, people have actually also, well, not people, researchers have also tried like a bin approach where they actually look at common mutations across cancers and try to design drugs that are rather specific to the mutation versus the cancer type. So that's happening for sure. But what I really wanted to say is that it is very broad, and each cancer type on its own is quite unique and requires specialists, you know, in that particular cancer type. So what is going on? I guess, what is the landscape of cancer research? I think I was thinking about whether I could like summarize it into four or five main categories, but I think they're probably way more. I'd say some of the, you know, like hottest things going on right now in cancer research are things like personalized medicine, immunotherapy, improving like how we diagnose people. So things like imaging, and then maybe also, you know, people who work on kind of designing new drugs. Probably those are the four main areas of research. And then of course, within each cancer type, as I was mentioning, you know, they're done in quite different ways.
Yeah. And would you say that there are some of those sub areas that are doing much better than others? So I've heard a lot of talk about personalized medicine. I think every hospital and research institute's, say, five-year plan always has personalized medicine for every patient at the end of that five-year period. The problem is that they've been saying that for the last 15 years, and I suspect we're going to keep saying it for the next 15 years. I mean, there are a few types of breast cancer that are getting targeted therapies because of their genetic signatures.
Exactly.
But to me, the sad paradigm that most cancer continues to be slash, burn, and poison, really, like putting it bluntly, is how most cancers are treated. And that's why it's so harsh on patients.
Absolutely. I think from what I've been seeing, immunotherapy is probably the most likely to become like a fourth pillar to the three things that you just mentioned. So to go along with radiation, chemotherapy, and surgery. One of the hallmarks of cancer is that it's able to prevent itself from being attacked by the immune system. So it overcomes the normal immune response that a person would have. So if we are able to put a blockade on that, then we're able to actually allow our immune system to do the right thing and work to get rid of the tumor cells. So that's really exciting. And I think more and more hospitals are using things such as like PD-L1 inhibitors, things like this, or PD-1 inhibitors. So one of the challenges that remains in that area is that we still don't really know why some patients respond really well to this treatment while others don't. And I think it doesn't really work across all cancer types. So some cancer types may benefit from this sort of treatment more than others. So that's immunotherapy. And I think there's a lot of work that's showing promising results there. And I think eventually, like I said, it will become the fourth pillar of treatment. So as you were saying, personalized medicine, I think it achieved a lot of excitement when people were sort of planning out how they would implement personalized medicine in the clinic. And I think the idea is great. So for example, what is personalized medicine? It can be a number of things, but one of the ideas is that you probably, one of the more advanced, you know, let's say methods, is that you will be able to extract cells from the patient's tumor and then either develop a cell line using these cells or put these tumor cells into a mouse and actually develop like a xenograft, like a tumor in a mouse, and then treat it with a bunch of drugs, because you know you don't know right away which drug will work the best for this patient, and you can't give the patient all the different drugs because that would be way too toxic and expensive. So basically the idea is that you develop this model outside of the patient's body, treat it with a bunch of drugs, see which one works best, and then give that drug to the patient. So that sounds pretty cool, right? You can imagine like how quickly that becomes just not doable based on the limited number of resources and money and time, right? The patient can't just lie there waiting for the doctor to decide which drug to give them for weeks or months. So I don't really know when and if that will actually become realistic, but as you were saying, what is being done today is using genomic or transcriptomic data about the patient's tumor and then kind of deciding based on that which medicine to give to them. And I think that research is continuing to happen, and I think that that's actually pretty realistic as RNA sequencing, for example, becomes more and more common in the clinic.
Do you have a sense of how many cancers, say in the next 5 years, what percent of people with a diagnosis of cancer, any type, are going to receive treatment based on those genetic signatures? Like, I have no idea what the numbers are, but my intuition would be that in 5 years from now, it might be 5 or 10%. Is that too pessimistic of a number, or is that your intuition as well?
I don't think I have enough experience to make a really good guess on this right now. All I can say is that I hope and I think that it should actually be higher than 5 to 10%. At places like Princess Margaret Hospital, I'm almost confident that most patients, to some degree, get some genetic information. The doctors have some genetic information about the tumor, and it might not be something as nice as RNA sequencing, but I still think that they use as much as they can to understand about the tumor before they actually treat it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So I can absolutely imagine that Princess Margaret might be a leader here in Canada for that, and maybe even, I don't know, up to half or more of the patients could get some form of sequencing for their tumors. But I am confident that in most hospitals outside of Toronto, even if there were assays that could reveal useful information about the genetics of the tumor, that patients aren't receiving that, which gets to this problem of that not only are these treatments expensive, so for example, CAR T therapy for lymphomas and leukemias are, I don't know, around $500,000 US for a treatment, although they do last for a while, of course, if they put the cancer into remission. And there's the expertise that's needed to administer this. So extracting these cells and genetically engineering them is not a trivial thing that an undergrad could do over the weekend. Oh, this requires, yeah, it's really, you know, so this is going to bump into the issue of exacerbating potential existing health inequalities, right? So we're going to have, say, very effective treatments for specific genetic variants of cancers within, say, breast cancer, lung cancer, leukemias, lymphomas. And do you think that realistically our society is going to be able to distribute these treatments in a fair way?
To be most efficient, I think what might happen is we'll work on developing some sort of prognostic models to help us at least identify higher risk patients from lower risk patients. And obviously, you would probably, maybe I'm wrong, but you would probably prioritize the higher risk patients for treatments that are more limited, right? So things like CAR T cell therapy. But I think that the goal is still to be able to provide these treatments for as many people as possible. Now, if we know that a large portion of patients don't respond well to these treatments, then it might not make sense, right, to give everyone this really expensive treatment that might not even work for them. So I think we have to improve how we predict whether a treatment works for somebody or not. So that requires, you know, going back into looking at patients that did receive this treatment, look at who responded and who didn't, and assess the differences in genetics between them, the RNA sequencing, RNA levels. And actually, I read a paper a few years ago that actually looked at the microbiome, differences in microbiome between patients who responded to immunotherapy and those who didn't, right? Because we really don't understand how or why this happens. So I think more research is needed in that area before we can actually decide to, you know, in the ideal world, to give everyone this treatment.
If the gut's distribution of bacteria and other things is really important for cancer, who knows what else is important? Absolutely. And I think this bumps up against the issue is that cancer is just a wicked problem, right? So anyone who does programming know that it's essential to have version control, to have well-commented code. And to me, the human genome is just a coding disaster. Right? We don't know how it was coded. We don't know who the contributors were. We don't know why genes are the way they are in certain ways, what makes them go wrong, what makes them work well outside of a few well-known cases. And I wonder if there's just going to be a natural limit, just some cancers that might have 100 driver mutations. We're just never going to be able to figure out all the combinations that really make this cancer tick and therefore have effective treatments for it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way to think about it. And it makes me remember, you know, there are big consortiums like the TCGA that have released a lot of papers on individual cancer types where they looked at basically which genes are most commonly mutated and things like that, right? So that's where maybe driver mutations come from. Because if you look at a large cohort of, let's say, thyroid tumors, and you see that the same gene is mutated in 100% of these patients, which, by the way, it's always never the case, but let's say, then you'll be like, you'll consider targeting that gene, right? Because if it's always mutated and all these patients have thyroid cancer, maybe by targeting this specific gene or protein, you'll be able to help these patients, right? So when you actually look at these papers, they almost always have this sort of tile plot where you have patients, you know, on one axis, and then on the other axis you have all the genes, and then each patient has a box where they're mutated in a given gene, right? So then you have this like lineup of boxes. So if the gene is mutated in all patients, you would basically have a row of boxes filled in for each patient. But in most cases, you see, I don't know, let's say at most like 3/4 of the patients have a mutation in the same gene. That gene is probably a driver mutation or a gene, because the reason why we call these driver mutations is in a random world, like it's very unlikely that all these patients will have a mutation either in the same position or, you know, spread across the same gene. So if we see that happening more than we would expect by chance, there's reason to believe that it could be a driver mutation. Now, why I was saying this in the first place is because there's always that quarter of patients or some subset of patients that don't have that mutation, right? They don't really cluster with the rest of the patients. So like, what happens to those patients? You know, like in each cancer type, we have these patients who might look different from the rest. And I would expect that those patients would suffer from less options being available to them because their profiling just doesn't match most of the other patients. And each patient at the end of the day, each tumor is completely different than, you know, some other patient's tumors. So we just do our very best to try and predict what is common and what is potentially driving a common disease. But at the end of the day, there's lots of evidence to suggest that even in like inter-tumor heterogeneity and even intra-tumor heterogeneity can have a big effect on whether someone actually responds to treatment or doesn't.
One of the implications of what I'm understanding you're saying is that in the future, we could have potentially some very good treatments for certain types of subtypes of cancer. So you have a specific type of lung cancer. And the reason might be is that we know that there are some variants that are sufficient to cause that cancer. And if we can kind of fix the protein coding problem that variant causes, we might be able to affect the cancer, which I think is what happens for some of the early successes with like Gleevec, where if you have a specific type of BCR-ABL mutation on your Philadelphia chromosome, I don't exactly understand the exact details of it, but we can provide treatments. So if you're in that 20 to 30% of people with ALL that have that, you can get treatments, but the other 70% is standard chemotherapy. And you get to this kind of poignancy where you're like, well, what type of, you're like, you have lung cancer, but then the big question is, but what type of lung cancer do you have? Because the other person being diagnosed with it might expect to live 20 years where you might expect to only live like 3 or 4, which is this kind of sad inequality that might arise between different cancer patients, right?
And the mutations they end up having. Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. Now, we've kind of covered the cancer landscape. We've gotten some opinions on who exactly biologists are. So now I want to move to what exactly you do, Karina. So I've heard you talk about your research before. It's got lots of interesting and impressive sounding terms like long non-coding RNAs, microRNAs, link RNAs. Can you talk a little bit about these things and try to put them in the most general terms possible? So pretend I'm a first-year student.
Sure. In my master's thesis project, I became interested in genes that don't actually end up being proteins. So most of us know that a given, you know, piece of DNA that codes for a gene will be first transcribed to become RNA or specifically messenger RNA, which most of us will remember from like high school. And then these messenger RNAs become translated into proteins. And proteins have really important functions in our cells, obviously, right? From things like maintaining DNA replication, cell cycle. It's just a really wide range of functions that these proteins basically pardon. And for a long time, we were under the understanding that there were roughly 20,000 genes right across the genome that take this route, right? So 20,000 genes that become messenger RNAs that then become proteins. But if you look at all the DNA, these 20,000 genes only make up 2% of the genome.
So what's right? The other 98% doing?
Yeah, so that's kind of where people like me and others who are interested in non-coding genome, that's where kind of we're interested in finding out. There's a lot that can go on in the non-coding genome. I probably have taken too long to talk about each one, but I guess I'll just focus on what I was interested in. So I was specifically interested in genes that do get transcribed into RNA, but not necessarily messenger RNA. So they don't become translated into proteins. So basically just live their life as RNAs and never become proteins. And we don't really know for sure how many of these genes there are, but it can be up to like 100,000, probably more, of these non-coding RNAs. And then within the non-coding RNA world, so again, RNAs that don't make proteins, there are lots of subtypes. So you can have things like microRNAs or miRNAs, long non-coding RNAs, which are link RNAs, and several others. And these basically get divided based on how long they actually are. So microRNAs are usually quite short, whereas, you know, as you might guess, long non-coding RNAs are longer. So they're usually longer than 200 base pairs or nucleotides. That's kind of, hopefully that gives you an idea of what the non-coding genome might encompass. And there's a lot more that goes on there as well. So you can imagine why so many of us are interested in this. So that's how I got into looking at long non-coding RNAs. And that's what I spent basically my master's project doing. And now we're trying to wrap up this paper. We're collaborating with an experimental lab that's actually looking at the expression of some of these long non-coding RNAs in a brain cancer in different models, so like cell lines and mice. In my current job, I'm working at a lymphoma lab as a computational biologist. And here, we're definitely interested eventually to look at microRNA and link RNA expression in different subtypes of lymphoma, but that hasn't been, let's say, the primary focus right now. Right now, we're mostly interested in I guess a few different things. So one of the projects is looking at clonal evolution in lymphoma. So lymphoma is a blood cancer, but it's quite interesting because there's a lot of, I guess, transport that maybe happens to these cells. So when a patient actually gets diagnosed on their scans, a doctor might see actually lots of regions in the body that have lymphoma, and that might, you know, scare the patient because that kind of might give the idea of metastasis, which in other cancer types, you know, is a really, really, really bad sign. But in the case of lymphoma, it's actually quite common for it to spread across the, you know, lymph vessels, and you end up having these different regions in the body with lymphoma. And one of the things that doctors currently don't really understand is how to define which tumor came first and which came later. And that might help us in the future improve, you know, how we design certain drugs and how we treat the cancer, because we know that clonal evolution happens and the different tumors in the same person's body might actually look quite different from each other, right? Because the tumor or the cancer evolves and it gains new mutations that allow it to continue growing and striving, right? So that's one of the projects, and that's been pretty interesting because it allowed me to learn a lot more about clonal evolution and the different tools that you can use to kind of try and predict the pattern of evolution across the tumor. And there are other projects in the labs currently going on to, you know, test out different drug combinations and understand why it actually works better, trying to identify subtypes of lymphoma using methylation profiling. So several different things going on right now.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And, you know, you bring up all of these issues, like, you know, we could focus in on probably 100 things that based on the last 2 to 3 minutes of what you've said, it really highlights, again, the challenge of why treatments for cancer are so hard, because there are so many things going on, right? Methylation, tumorigenesis, like how the tumor's evolving, how these other factors in the genome play in, like the non-coding RNAs you mentioned. And I want to go back to that quickly. So you said that 2% of the human genome is dedicated to basically coding the proteins that go up to basically making all of the tissues and basically doing everything in our body. So those are the direct genes that we see expressed. But then the other 98% has some sort of regulatory function for how that gets produced. Is non-coding RNAs the other 98%, or are they a subset of that 98%?
Yeah, I would say they're a subset of the 98%, because within 90%, you definitely have regions of DNA that might not get transcribed, but that have important regulatory functions, right? So a region of DNA might act as an enhancer, for example. So enhancers are regions, regulatory regions in the DNA that allow certain transcription factors, for example, or regulatory proteins to bind and actually help with gene activation or repression. So they're basically, you can imagine these regulatory complexes that form. And there are a lot more other complex things that go on. For example, I don't know if you're familiar with like DNA looping.
Definitely not, no.
Yeah, so yeah, I guess the easiest way to explain what that is if you imagine how long your DNA actually is, right? The reason why it's actually able to be compact in a single cell is because of the way that it kind of loops on itself, like literally. And basically in the last maybe, you know, 5 to 10 years, there's been a lot of new research on these sort of looping dynamics, because depending on how the loops get formed, that will also affect which genes get expressed when and whether they get expressed together or not. That just adds like another layer of complexity and like regulation that also can go into that 98%.
So I don't know how to exactly phrase this question, but how much else is there that we don't know? My sense is that, you know, these long non-coding RNAs, microRNAs, link RNAs, I'm guessing in the year 2000, when we finished the first iteration of the Human Genome Project, we didn't know about these things. Is that correct? Like, are these newly discovered things?
No, I would say, I think one of the earliest link RNAs was, I think, discovered in the 80s or 90s.
Okay.
So yeah, it's definitely, and there's been a few other ones that kind of have come up. So these are usually really, really highly expressed link RNAs, the ones that kind of came up earlier. In discovery, because they would just be easier to detect. But a lot of other link RNA is actually quite lowly expressed, which is another reason why only recently with better sequencing technologies we've actually been able to detect and annotate them.
Okay, gotcha. So the qualitative or conceptual knowledge of these different types of mechanisms at the molecular biological level have been known, but actually figuring out how to measure them and the extent of their various forms is still under active investigation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And why is it so hard to actually see what the heck is going on inside a human cell, right? Like why is it so difficult? We can't just open it up like it's a little dollhouse and see all the constituent components. Why is it so hard to do molecular biology and understand really what's going on?
One challenge, first of all, is that you can imagine the things that go on in a cell. It's a very dynamic environment. So, you know, something can be methylated 1 second or 1 minute or 1 hour, and then when you look at it again, it might be methylated. So you end up thinking, okay, like, you know, what is important? Is it that it's methylated or not methylated? Is it that the gene is expressed or is it not expressed? Because sometimes depending on the time point that you look at, you know, the cell might look quite different. So that's why in every experiment, you know, we usually require at least 3 replicates, right? Because you want to try and average out the signal to see what the average signal is for a given feature that you're looking at, such as methylation. So that's definitely one challenge, kind of capturing the, you know, the constantly changing environment and cellular states.
Right. So it's just not a static snapshot.
Yeah. Probably other challenges have to do more with like the inherent noise that's present in any given experiment. So, you know, with things like ChIP-seq, for example, you're relying on how good the antibody actually is, right, at attaching itself to the specific regions where it should be attaching itself to. There are tons of examples like this in every experiment that gets done to try and evaluate methylation, expression, looping structures, all these things. So a lot of it comes down to trying to separate the signal from the noise.
So before we go back to some more biomedical questions, I'm going to take a break right now and we're going to go to the lightning round. So I want to ask some more lighthearted questions. So okay. We're going to start with a category I'm calling underrated versus overrated. So feel free to pass on these or reply with neutral if you feel that they're adequately rated. Okay, first one, Kazakhstan.
Underrated.
Why?
Well, I think most people, when they think of Kazakhstan, they probably think of like Borat or something.
That's fair. Yeah, I think that's
true. But it's a really culturally rich and diverse country, you know, based on the history. Like, there are just so many different ethnicities there. It's also a really beautiful country. I personally haven't actually had the chance to go hiking or skiing in Kazakhstan. And the last time I was there, I was 6 years old, and the day everyone went hiking, I was unfortunately sick, couldn't go. But from what I've heard and from the pictures I've seen, it's just a beautiful place and fairly, you know, fairly friendly and safe. Food, you know, there's just so much good stuff, and I think people don't really think about it usually.
After Corona passes, maybe mm-hmm. time to plan that trip to Kazakhstan.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. Eric Topol, underrated or overrated?
Oh, I don't think he's overrated.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's very prolific, right?
I'm just impressed by how much he's able to like put out there, like the speed and just how fast he must be able to read and like put his thoughts together. It's just impressive.
On and top he's of, a like, doctor and he has a family.
Yeah, I was just going to say on top of his actual job of being a doctor.
All right, next one, Toronto.
No, not overrated.
Not overrated?
No.
Okay, that's fair. Moving on, peer review.
I don't think it's a really binary answer. I think there's room for improving how it's done, let's say. So it's definitely something that should always be done. But I'm just wondering if there are ways to improve how it's done.
All right, two more questions here for overrated or underrated. Top rope climbing.
Wow, Eric. Underrated or overrated? I don't know. Probably underrated. I don't want to say it's overrated.
Yeah, it's definitely very trendy, but has it become too trendy?
I wouldn't say so just yet. I think it's fine for people to want to try this new sport and explore it and see if they truly want to commit to it. And top roping is fairly safe. So I think it's great if people want to try it and commit to it.
All right, last overrated versus underrated question. And this one's going to be a bit controversial, so don't feel like you need to be political or anything like that. PhDs.
Okay, well, I guess I'm in the process of deciding whether I want to do a PhD, so I'm leaning towards more of a yes. So I would probably say it's not overrated, although that may change in the next 6 months, I don't know. I think it's really personal at the end of the day. A lot of people who are in the process of completing their PhDs or have completed their PhDs say that it's overrated. And sometimes, for example, I think that if I jumped straight into PhD after my undergrad, I probably would have not had that good of an experience because mm-hmm. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to focus on, and I just didn't have the skills that I think would help you have a successful PhD. But even then, like when you start your PhD and you think that it's perfect, the environment is perfect, the lab is perfect, everything's perfect, the reality is like within a year, everything could change, right? So it's definitely like a riskier adventure to embark on. Right now, I'm pretty excited to consider that as an option for myself.
I'm hearing a sympathetic defense of PhDs, but that's fair. I mentioned that I think you're one of the people who a PhD could actually be quite beneficial for. And so the next question is going to be related to that. What is the Karen Isayev production function? So how is it that you have 11 papers on Google Scholar, including publications in cancer research, molecular cell, and Nature, all with just a single master's degree? How have you managed to be so fruitful in your published research, Karina?
I think I should probably give a shout out to my master's advisor, because he actually allowed me to become a part of several different projects that led to papers. So I guess one of the benefits of being in computational biology is that you can build a lot of collaborations with labs that don't do computational biology themselves. I think he was quite good at building these collaborations and bringing me onto them and helping out to a degree that allowed me to be an author on a paper. So I think part of it was definitely luck, just, you know, being in the right place at the right time. I don't really know what else to say.
One of the things I know I have challenges with, and I think other people do too, is really just being able just to get to the finish line, right? So, you know, you're 80% of the way there, but really pushing yourself to get over the last 20% seems to be the hard part. Have you found any strategies of how you're able to just get that paper out and submitted?
So submitting a paper or finishing a paper is one thing, and getting it accepted and published is a whole other story. So, you know, during my master's, I wasn't really, like, my advisor was the one really dealing with that submission process and dealing with the, like, you know, talking to the editor and figuring out how to revise it and all this stuff. But in my current job, I've been experiencing it a lot more, like, firsthand. And it's a really tough process. Even when you think your paper is great and you've done everything you can to make it as good as possible, and then you have these reviewers who don't seem to agree, you know, it's a really tough battle. And I think the first reaction is to be defensive and say, how could they say no? This paper is so good. Why can't they just publish it? But I think a better way to deal with it is just to try and take the feedback and put it into the paper and make it even better and resubmit, if not to the same journal, then to a different journal. And stay positive and believe that if you're trying to publish this paper, it has a purpose and eventually you'll get there. You know, maybe it won't be your dream journal, but I think that that also has to do with some politics in science, but that's a whole other conversation. Just in terms of finishing a project to full completion, which I would say is actually getting it published, it's definitely a long road in many cases, but you just gotta stay positive and commit to just making your paper as good as possible rather than be defensive of what others can say, what reviewers say.
Yeah, sounds like don't take it too personally is a good philosophy here.
Don't take it too personally, and yeah, just focus on making the science as good as possible before it comes out to the world.
So my last general question here, before I pivot back to just a few final questions for biomedical research, is what are some of the challenges that women face in science specifically? Have you had any negative experiences in this? And what are the barriers for more women getting involved in computational biology, if you think there are any?
I think one of the first things that comes to mind is just how little women, I guess, PIs there are in computational biology. Like at U of T, you know, maybe aside from Anna Goldenberg, I can't even really, I'm sure there are some, I just, you know, it's really, there's just a lot less women doing this type of research that are already at the same position, at a position such as a PI. So that's hard for, you know, students, because when you look at the list of potential PIs and they're all men, it's just kind of like a weird message, right? So hopefully more and more women actually able to rise up to that level and actually become mentors to other women and things like that. I have, I guess, luckily not had really bad experiences in that way. I'd say maybe it's more personal. Like I think on a personal level, it does affect like my confidence. I think compared to like the average person or the average man, let's say, I probably like perceive myself as less confident, and that definitely affects how I present myself and how I communicate. And I guess this is an example, like if someone was going to say something and I disagreed with it, I would be a lot less likely to say something back, you know. Even though I think I'm right, I would like wait for them to either understand that they're wrong themselves or like ask for my opinion. But obviously I'm trying to work on that. And I think that's more of a personal thing.
I wanted to hear your experience on that front. So thank you for sharing that with us. Right, yeah. So one of the few last questions I want to talk about are some of the things that I work with and I think that we have in common, which are the uses and abuses of statistics in this field. As biologists have done more and more computational work, the inferences about whether there's actually a difference in, say, the frequency of mutations, which you mentioned earlier as an example of something that would be important to know about, or whether there's differences in the distribution of genetic variants for phenotypes like height or the tendency to vote for Brexit, for example. That's an actual study. And I feel that statistics is used as this mechanism to settle these disputes, but a lot of people using these tools, they don't appreciate the statistics itself is quite subjective. So the rules of probability are as solid and rigorous as mathematics is, but statistics requires assumptions. And I fear that a lot of biological conclusions are being driven by a sense that if the statistics come out down on the side of the hypotheses you're trying to reject or accept, you tend to treat that with more confidence than you really should. Do you have this intuition as well, that statistics is being abused in a way to sort of settle hypotheses and give that more credibility than they really should or shouldn't have?
I think the consequences of these decisions and misuses have obviously the most impact on clinical studies and clinical trial design, for example. Obviously, that's not my area of expertise, but Frank Harrell does a lot of work on this, and sometimes I try to read up on what he's saying. So I would refer to his blog on posts that I think are probably most relevant to this question. Yeah, in our lab, what I appreciate is we kind of try and consider all these things before making a final decision on something, rather than just going based off of like a single p-value. That's definitely, I think, not the right approach.
Okay, yeah. I wonder though, have you ever seen a presentation or a paper where, you know, they've shown all the three stars that this is a really significant p-value, and you've thought to yourself, it's like, well, I mean, there could be a lot of other things that are causing this to appear. Like this is something that you notice as well?
For sure. And I think something that does kind of pop up in my head as we're talking about this is I think the lack of, I guess, intuition that most grad students especially have regarding the p-value and multiple testing adjustments. So I was, you know, helping someone do an analysis, and they were looking at their p-values, and they had a bunch of tests, and they were like, oh, look at all these significant p-values. And I was like, okay, but have you done, you know, like a multiple test correction? And they were like, what's that? And I was like, oh. I think for me personally, it was something that took me a while to really, and I might still not have a perfect intuition of these things, but I try to put effort into developing an intuition for these things, because it's just, you know, a question that comes up all the time, whether it's in a seminar or a committee meeting or a thesis defense. And I think a lot of people struggle with having an intuition for these things, and then they go and make conclusions about these things. So it's just like not a good combination.
Yeah. And one of the things I worry about though is statistics being used, and this isn't my term, I'm stealing it, but for uncertainty laundering, which is that you start out with uncertainty, somehow you put it through a statistical model, and then the uncertainty goes away. That you get this dichotomous thinking that before I was uncertain, but now I'm actually sure that this hypothesis isn't true. And I wish that statistics wasn't able to be used in such a sharp way. But I think, as you say, really getting first an intuition of what these statistics are, these tools and these metrics could actually, and what they're actually implying, what it means to have a p-value of 1%, and what are the assumptions that go into that could be really useful. So one other thing I wanted to ask you is that how we fund cancer research, is this really helping us get to the goal of having, you know, 20 to 50% of people being treated with some sort of personalized medicine, right? So you and I have worked for labs that get most of their funding based on grants, which maybe fund a certain research topic for 2 to 5 years. Do you have a sense of if you think this is the right model? Do we need more variation in that? Do we need more prizes for, say, the first group to come up with a solution to the following problem? Is the grant-based system just encouraging too much salami slicing of small subsets of problems that, you know, we can figure out in 2 to 3 years and then move on to another small problem, and we never really get to the bigger picture that's going to actually drive, you know, real treatments for patients?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't really know what the ideal solution is, and that's an interesting thing to think about. I know that a lot of PIs have a problem with how grants are currently divided up on a national level through things like NSERC or CHR. It seems like there's a lot of unfairness, and it seems that there are a lot of challenges, especially for younger PIs whose research may not be one of the top three like hot topics right now, but whose research is still nevertheless is meaningful, right? That's why they have a lab. That's why they have a job. What I can comment on more is the way that employees in a lab get paid is often through a grant. And there's usually like, an amount that gets put aside for the employee's salary. I think one of the challenges, and this is just my personal opinion, especially in the field of machine learning or computational biology, these are people who have quite useful skills that could really be applied to any field. I think, again, my personal opinion is that a lot of these people end up committing to research more because of a personal like interest rather than like a financial interest. I think their salaries are usually, a lot lower than what they could get in a different field. It's just the way that people are paid in an academic setting. It's just not as competitive. I think if, this could be taken into account, if people who are in academic settings doing research, contributing to new technologies that actually used, in the clinic, I think these people should be compensated more competitively. And this would allow more high-skilled people to actually keep their jobs rather than look for other jobs and do better research.
No, absolutely. And again, maybe after coronavirus, if funding for biomedical research increases, we'll see how much of that goes to paying higher wages to attract more staff, or whether basically PIs and institutions will capture most of that increase in funding. So let's hope it's the former. I think that's a really good point. This is also a bit of a open-ended question, so feel free to respond to it any way you'd like. One of the things that I've heard Asra Raza, who's a oncologist and wrote this really interesting book, The First Cell, recently, and she was interviewing a neuroscientist about whether or not they're too reductionistic in terms of understanding how consciousness or the brain works from, say, studying a single, neuron or axon. And there was this really great quote from the book I'm just going to read now, which said, "Taking apart the Taj Mahal brick by brick to discover the source of its beauty will yield only rubble. It is the same with the brain. The emergent complexity from simple individual parts accounts for its essential mystery." And this is where it has relevance for cancer research. Quote, "It is also the reason why cancer will not yield its secrets through a reductionistic approach." And by that, Dr. Raza is referring to doing very simple experiments on single gene or single variant mutations, hoping to understand the bigger picture about cancer. Do you feel that our funding or our research is too focused on these small components of cancer? Do we need to have a more systems or bigger picture view of how these mechanisms work?
That's an interesting question. There are benefits to doing studies focused on, let's say, one gene at a time, because even if that doesn't end up solving cancer, it would still improve our understanding of individual proteins that have important functions in our cells. And funny thing about disease research, of any disease really, is that a lot of medicine gets used, so for example, like statins were initially used for, I think, like hypertension or high blood pressure. And, a lab at U of T actually, I think they found that it had some mechanisms in metabolic pathways that were also implicated in tumor development. So all of a sudden you can test whether giving statin to these, cancer patients will actually help. And I think they're doing clinical trials right now. So it's kind of a funny, coincidence almost, right? Because that wasn't really their primary research, but then it kind of happened and now it's in a clinical trial. Versus something that they've been studying for 20 years, is nowhere close to being in a clinical trial. So that's quite, that happens quite often. So my point is that, even if doing cancer research and we're focusing on one gene or one protein, and maybe the finding won't help with a particular cancer type, perhaps actually knowing more about that protein will help us down the road with maybe another disease. So I think there's still benefits to studying individual proteins and genes and individual pathways and mechanisms. Of course, it's not on a global scale efficient, because ideally, we would like to somehow parallelize these studies, and that's definitely really challenging. Even then, let's say, nowadays it's really common with cancer research. If you're looking at a particular cancer type, you'll do all the possible sequencing that you can on this tumor, right? So you'll do whole genome sequencing, RNA sequencing. You'll sequence the methylation profiles through bisulfite sequencing. You'll look at how the loop structures form. You know, there are just so many tests that you can do. And then let's say you have all this data. Like, how do you actually combine it in a meaningful way? I think that's an exciting problem, because if we're able to combine that data in an interesting way, in theory, that should tell us more than just what a single gene is mutated, which gene is mutated. It could paint a bigger picture of what's going on in the tumor cells. So I'm actually really interested in how that could be potentially done, because I think perhaps they'll be able to answer more questions than just looking at one of these experiments one at a time. I think a lot of people are quite maybe pessimistic about the overall progress. You know, a lot of people like who don't do cancer research, when they find out that I do, they always ask me like, oh, when do you think cancer will be like cured? Do you think like pharma is just lying to us? And like, I'm not joking, this is real stuff. Like, people actually think these things, that actually there's already a cure and they're just not providing it because, you know, these companies are benefiting from selling these drugs. But I do think that there is, I think the rate at which we are developing new treatments or tests, I think it is increasing. And with labs working more and more together through collaboration, I think things will happen quicker. And I think it's important to stay motivated. For many cancer types, there's still been lots of improvement over the last 10 or more years, and it's continuing to improve. So we have to stay focused on the positives and continue working through the challenges. I would say that one of the things about research in general, and it makes sense, because for a PI, for their lab to succeed, they need grants, which means they need publications. So I think sometimes it becomes hard not to only focus on that. Like, how many publications do I have? Will I publish this year? Will I get this grant? To lose focus of the bigger picture, which at the end of the day is to actually do something meaningful for cancer patients. I think maybe, you know, if the grants were managed, would be different. That would actually help scientists stay more focused on their actual job, which is to do science, than to just write grants for weeks at a time.
Yeah, what I'm hearing you say is that there are definitely a lot of areas for improvement. You know, we need different types of research. Like you said, we need to parallelize some of these things. And there are some negative incentives about how PIs direct their research that has nothing to do with scientific progress, but is more about CV or career progress. But that overall, you're still pretty positive with the direction and the long-run implications of this field. I'm actually really glad you mentioned this, because I want to end with a quote that Bill Clinton gave in the year 2000. So this was 20 years ago, after the first, again, iteration of the human genome had been sequenced in the Human Genome Project. What I want you to answer is, after I've read this, is, do you think that this statement should have been given today rather than 20 years ago? So this is what he said. With this profound new knowledge, humankind is on the verge of gaining an immense new power to heal. Genome science will have a real impact on all of our lives, and even more on the lives of our children. It will revolutionize the diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of most, if not all, human diseases. In the coming years, doctors increasingly will be able to cure diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, diabetes, and cancer by attacking their genetic roots. In fact, it is now conceivable that our children's children will know the term cancer only as a constellation of stars. And today we know that Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will not be cured anytime soon, and their genetic roots are extremely complicated. But do you think that today a similar sentiment could be said? Was Bill Clinton too optimistic 20 years ago?
Yes, I think a lot of people were really optimistic. I mean, I think that's fine. I think it was a really exciting thing that happened, and people were excited and optimistic that it would make a huge difference on how we treat diseases. And unfortunately, that didn't really happen. But I don't think that's, you know, all bad. I think a lot of technology still evolved and developed thanks to this. A similar thing happened, I think, with sequencing of many, many, many different patient tumors. I think the hope there was similar, that we would be able to find the ideal targets in each cancer type for treatment. We would be able to understand the different subtypes and what goes on in each cancer type. But again, you'll see there's several posts about this where, unfortunately, like, that didn't really happen, aside from a few cases, maybe in breast cancer or lung cancer, where some new treatments were actually developed based on specific mutations that were found through studies like this. But again, like, we still have this, you know, resource now that we can still use today and in the future. We still did learn a lot about what we don't know. And I think that's still important, and it kind of gives us a direction for what to do next. So I think it's fine that through, you know, these years, we did find the cure for all. I think our genomes are just really, really complicated, and different diseases are just maybe more complicated than we gave them credit for. So I think overall that statement is overly optimistic, and I think we should stay realistic and just work as hard as we can to make progress while staying realistic as well, because we don't want to give the population false hope. I think we didn't really talk about this today, but there's a lot of work being done to actually improve trust between the general public and scientists and doctors. We want to make sure that, you know, we don't lose their trust, because we need them to really follow what we suggest. Like, for example, now during the COVID-19 pandemic, like, it's really important that the general public actually adheres to what the scientists and public health professionals are saying. So I think it's important to not be overly optimistic in any sort of statements, because we don't want the general public to think these things that might never happen and then lose trust in science overall.
Karina, thank you for ending on an optimistic but realistic note at the same time. And thank you for answering all of these broad, open-ended questions about genetics. I definitely learned a lot. I think I have a much better sense of where cancer research is, where it's going, and what you're interested in as well, too.
For sure. I would say also, like I said, you know, I'm still learning so much. So all these things are kind of, a lot of them are my personal opinion and what I've sort of learned so far. But I hope to also continuing to improve my understanding of these things as well.
Great. Thank you, Karina. This has been the fourth episode of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast. We look forward to seeing you again, and stay safe, everybody.
Thanks, Eric.